I wanted to write a story about World War II in Queensland, and 1942 was a really interesting year. I'd actually written a whole novel set in Queensland, and it wasn't quite working. And in the research, I was looking at Rabaul, because Rabaul was the Japanese stronghold at the time, and that's where all the planes were coming from that were bombing North Queensland. And so it was suggested to me that I write a nonfiction book. And then in looking at Rabaul, it led me to this family that I'd read about as a sort of a pendant to some of the war histories, about a family that had been tried and executed for espionage and included an 11-year-old boy, although his age had varied depending on which report. And I thought, oh, look, that's a great story. I'll write about this little boy who was executed. And so in trying to research Dickie Manson, I just came across a brick wall. There was really nothing about him, but there was very little information. So it took ages to track down the family, to find his real name, because even by the age of 11, he'd had three different names. So in tracking Dickie down, it helped me tell the story of Rabaul, which is in itself also an incredible story from World War II, really, that Australians don't remember at all. My name's Ian Townsend, and I'm a journalist by trade, but I've been writing books in recent years, and my most recent book was Line of Fire, which is about Rabaul in the Second World War, and a civilian family, including an 11-year-old boy, who were tried and executed for espionage in Rabaul by the Japanese.
It's something I hadn't heard of before, and the idea of an 11-year-old boy being executed is just horrific. Tell us what this 11-year-old boy's family were doing in Rabaul at the time.
Well, Rabaul was the capital of New Guinea, and New Guinea was an Australian territory. So it was the Australian territory of New Guinea, and this family were Australians, and many Australians lived in New Guinea at the time. It was considered by many as being Australian soil, and I think we forget our close ties with New Guinea today. But back then, Rabaul was considered an Australian town, the capital of New Guinea. The residents were listed in the Queensland Post Office Directory. Rabaul had a Queensland State School, a Queensland Police, and Australian cars. They drank Australian beer at the pubs. It looked like a Queensland town. And a lot of the buildings were on stilts. You know, those old Queenslander buildings with the red roofs? That was Rabaul. So it looked and smelt and felt, sounded like a Queensland town, and New Guinea was an Australian territory. So this family, it's a very complicated story, as family stories often are, but they'd come to New Guinea looking for work. And it was the end of the Depression, so people were moving around. There was still difficulty in people finding work. Families were struggling to live, to even get enough money to get food on the table. So this particular family ended up, by various means, in Rabaul as a sort of extension of being in Australia. That's how they got there. Dickie himself was born in Adelaide in 1931, a working-class family and prospect. So the Great Depression was well and truly on then, and so the family and prospect was struggling. Dickie was born out of wedlock. His mum had had a relationship with a local bloke from the railways, and so they had Dickie. They eventually ended up getting married to legitimise Dickie's birth, and they lived together for a while. But in the end, the relationship broke up, and Dickie's mother, Marjorie Manson, Dickie was Dickie Manson, they moved to Brisbane, and then Marjorie got a job basically in New Guinea as a secretary for a local plantation owner called Ted Harvey, and Marjorie moved over there and eventually married Ted. So, well, married, I guess, in inverted commas. I'm not sure that there was actually a formal marriage, but they were considered to be a married couple, and they were partners, and they lived on this plantation on the sort of northern coast of the island of New Britain, which is part of New Guinea. And they lived there, this beautiful place, looked north over the Bismarck Sea, this coconut plantation with the palm trees over the beach, and the sun would set in the afternoons, and this beautiful sky, the sea was calm, and the fireflies would flit in from the jungle, and it was a pretty idyllic sort of life, especially for a family that had been poor for so long. So Marjorie and Dickie both felt that as if they'd fallen on their feet. This was in the late 1930s, just before war broke out. It was a fairly prosperous lifestyle in some ways. There wasn't huge amounts of money, although if you owned a plantation, you did make money. But the Depression really crippled a lot of the farmers. But the thing with living on a plantation in New Guinea was that you could grow your own food. You had local people who were employed for a very small amount of money to do everything for you. So Marjorie had cooks and people to wash your clothes, and Dickie was doing correspondence. So it was a pretty good lifestyle, even if you were poor. And Ted Harvey himself had actually just inherited a lot of money, so they weren't actually that poor. And they actually had a little gold mine behind the plantation as well. So when before he'd inherited the money, when times are tough, they'd scratch a little gold and sell it illegally. So strangely, the Japanese traders who at that stage before the war were coming around the coast. So it wasn't a bad life, but things were getting a little bit unsettled in the world. But yeah, in New Guinea, especially in this plantation, they would have felt so far away from the troubles of the world, from the politics. It's probably as remote as you could probably get. And so they would have felt safe and secure, and it would have been a pretty happy life.
Mm. Was Dickie actually born Dickie Manson, or is that short for Richard?
I was born Richard Manson, that's right. Born in Adelaide at one of those hospitals for unwed mothers that had been set up, I think, by the Salvation Army. He was born into quite a big, very close family, but Marjorie, his mother, her mother, Phyllis, had also been born out of wedlock, and Phyllis and Marjorie clashed quite a bit. Phyllis, I think, was a bit worried that Marjorie was going to ruin her life, and as things happened at the, you know, during the Depression and young people, Marjorie got pregnant, and it was a terrible scandal in the family, but everybody accepted Dickie. And eventually Marjorie, as I said, did marry Dickie's father, a bloke called Jack Gazney, who worked on the local railway station. He was also a wrestler. During the Depression, he lost his job just after Dickie was born, and Jack went off. Marjorie and Dickie were left in Prospect, and Jack went off looking for gold, as many people did during the Depression. Young blokes, the only really commodity that kept its value during the Depression was gold, so Jack went off looking for gold and ended up in Kalgoorlie, and Marjorie eventually followed him there, and they were married secretly. The family never knew, and even to this day, the family was unaware that they'd actually been married. So Dickie was born Dickie Manson. When Marjorie married Jack Gazmere, he was Dickie Gazmere, and later when he moved to New Guinea, he was known as Dickie Harvey. So by the age of 11, he'd had three different names. One of the reasons it was difficult researching was because of this trail of different names and trying to piece the puzzle together. And there wasn't really much information about the boy. There's still very little evidence that he actually existed. There's photographs that the family has. There's some school records and then his birth certificate, but that's about it. There's very little information known. So it's one of those stories that's difficult to pin together when a large proportion of the family die and records are destroyed. That's what happens during war, especially to civilians. So in trying to piece together a civilian family in the Second World War, when Australian territory was overrun, the civilians suffer the most. And the reason why we don't hear much about the civilians is because very few records survive and very few people survive to tell the story. This is the problem. I think the problem why we haven't heard much about, well, anything really about Dickie Manson, and very little about what happened in Rabaul at the start of the war, which is an incredible story in itself.
Mm. Well, you're an author known for your books about times of national disaster. How did you first stumble across the story of Dickie Manson and his mother and stepfather?
Yeah, I'd written a couple of novels, and I wanted to write another novel set in 1942. I think 1942 is a very interesting year. I mean, my parents from that era always described the Second World War as being a terrible time, but it was also a time when people felt very much alive, that the whole country was at risk, and people lived in the moment. And I think in many ways it was an exciting time for many people, and I wanted to try to capture that. Obviously a tragic time for many people as well, but it was an exciting time. My parents described it as a hard time, but I think they had the time of their life in many ways, and they survived, of course, and didn't really experience the war, but personally, that sort of tragedy, luckily, fortunately, escaped my family. But I was trying to capture that feeling in Australia. It was always interesting, and the Japanese attacks on the Queensland coast were of interest, and so I decided to write about that, and then in trying to write about that, I discovered Rabaul, which was the source of a lot of attacks on Australia, which was Australian territory, which surprised me. I never really thought or heard much about. I knew vaguely that New Guinea was Australian territory, but I hadn't realised how Australian it was. And this capital, Rabaul, was an Australian town. And so I'd started looking at that, and then the reasons why the war started and why the Japanese came down. So there's quite a few astonishing things going on here, the event itself, but also why Australia has forgotten this event. And that's intriguing. You can just imagine, we'd been at war with Germany, so a lot of our troops were in the Middle East in 1941. And then Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941, and Australia declared war. I think in Australia we have this idea, you know, we have this sort of narrative of what happened during the war to make sense of it. And you think of the attack on Pearl Harbor, America and Australia then joining the war in the Pacific, and then the Japanese coming down through Asia, and then, you know, the fall of Singapore, and then the bombing of Darwin, and then, you know, the pushback, the Americans coming and pushing the Japanese back. But it didn't quite happen like that. So that's the idea we have. But the real story for Australia is that just a few weeks after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the declaration of war, the Japanese came straight down to Rabaul. They crossed the equator about New Year's Eve. The fleet that attacked Pearl Harbor joined up with another fleet for an invasion, and they came straight down over the equator and they invaded Rabaul. Rabaul was in their sights. It was Australian territory, and Rabaul was defended by a battalion, the 2nd 22nd, otherwise known as Lark Force, and they had a squadron of Wirraways. It was all set up. Rabaul, this beautiful harbour, Australian territory, an Australian town. It was within striking distance of the Japanese naval base of Truk, and so the Japanese wanted to make sure that the Americans didn't get to Rabaul first to counterattack, because Rabaul, the Americans had secretly built this long runway at Rabaul that could take B-17 bombers, and the Japanese knew that if the Americans got there with their B-17s, they'd be able to bomb Truk and the war would stop. So the Japanese very quickly came down and invaded Rabaul on the 23rd of January 1942. This was weeks before the fall of Singapore and the bombing of Darwin. Australian troops were in battle on Australian territory, you know, defending the beaches at Rabaul. There were air raids. Many people died, of course. And the battle itself is quite an incredible series of events. Of course, there were Australians in Rabaul were overwhelmed. Just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the declaration of war, the women and children were ordered to be evacuated from the Australian territories of New Guinea and Papua. And so most of the women and children did leave, but some stayed, and Marjorie and Dickie stayed to be with their family, because Marjorie had her brothers in Rabaul at that stage. She didn't want to leave a husband. And many people didn't actually think the Japanese would come down, and if they did come down, it was thought that they'd be left alone as owners of a plantation. They really didn't think that they would be part of this big, you know, what they, I guess, considered a big political scramble for resources in the Pacific. They didn't think it would really affect them, and that the Americans would very quickly turf them out anyway. So Marjorie made the decision to stay with Dickie. But during the invasion, Marjorie's brother George had actually just signed up to join the local militia, because this was Australian territory and the militia were allowed to fight on Australian territory. Militia came up from Victoria to fight at Rabaul. And George had just signed up. 24 hours later, he was on the beaches firing at the Japanese as they stormed ashore. And of course, the Japanese overwhelmed the small garrison at Rabaul. There were only about 1,600 members of the garrison, including the militia. They retreated. But a lot of the civilians were then trapped behind. So civilians were trapped. These were Australian civilians on Australian soil. They were trapped in their own homes. The men weren't allowed to be evacuated. So most of the civilians left behind were men. And basically a tragedy unfolded in slow motion over a period of 6 months. At the start of January 1942, before the invasion of Rabaul by the Japanese, there were about 2,000 Australians in the town of Rabaul and in around the town. Within 6 months, most of them were dead. So the reason why we don't hear much about this is because the people who were there who could tell the story, many of them didn't survive. Many who actually witnessed what happened and did survive were too traumatized to talk. And people died and suffered. People died in the jungle. There were massacres. And Dickie's family were executed, eventually, as spies. So this terrible tragedy unfolded, and Australia was unaware of it. When the invasion occurred, it was the front page of the newspapers in Australia, and the front page said Australian territory invaded. In fact, the acting Prime Minister, Frank Ford, Curtin was ill at that stage. It was Frank Ford who addressed the nation straight after the battle had started at Rabaul, and communications were cut. And so they knew that the Japanese were coming down. They knew that a battle had started, but they didn't really know quite what happened. Frank Ford declared this the start of the battle for Australia. And so for the first time, the Australian soil had been invaded. So it was very serious. Of course, then the war moved on quite quickly, and then because no word came out from Rabaul often, I mean, most people really didn't know what happened until after the war, it was forgotten, really. That never lodged in the national memory in the way that other battles do when there are reports from the front. You think of Gallipoli and Kokoda. Well, that never happened with Rabaul. It was completely cut off. What happened there was really unknown until after the war. Men did escape, but many of the men who escaped had retreated quite quickly in the battle and didn't really know what had happened to the civilians who were left behind. And so the whole thing was really, it never had the chance to be remembered, and it's been very difficult to reintroduce that memory into the, you know, the Australian story, unfortunately. It's one of the most significant, I think, events of World War II from Australia's perspective. It's probably Australia's worst wartime disaster. And it's never been remembered, and it's very difficult to talk to people about it because there's no point of reference for it. You know, often, you know, people don't really know much about Rabaul or New Guinea, but they'll know about Kokoda and they'll know about Singapore and the bombing of Darwin. But if you start to say, well, Rabaul happened before that, there's nothing really in the general national memory in which to place that because been told something a little bit different. Very unfortunate, really. I'm not sure that the memory of Rabaul will ever regain its place in the national story.
It's an extremely sad story, particularly given the thousands of people who perished there.
Well, and not to mention the local New Guineans. You know, the local people, this was Australian territory. The territories of New Guinea and Papua were really formed in different ways, but we still had an obligation to protect the people there. There's an estimate of 14,000 local New Guineans having died in and around Rabaul. And not to mention the Chinese who were left behind, the Malays, the multinational people of New Guinea. Most of them weren't given the chance to escape. They were left behind. It was the civilians who suffered the most, of course, in war, and that's what happened in Rabaul. The local battalion knew that an invasion was coming. The spotter planes had spotted the fleet coming down several days before, and there'd been air raids since the start of January on Rabaul. And so they knew what was coming, and they tried to prepare. And the Australian government believed its hands were tied, and so the battalion was left to its own devices to defend itself. And it was left there on purpose, and it wasn't reinforced on purpose. It was considered that it was a lost cause. So the Australian government called the people left behind in Rabaul hostages to fortune. There was no way of reinforcing them. There was plenty of opportunities right up until the last minute to evacuate the civilian men, but that wasn't done. So civilians and soldiers were left there. And they, you know, many of them, of course, were very happy to defend Australian territory. They thought it was their duty, and they're to be commended. It was quite a heroic act. But it was a tragedy. And I think another reason why we don't remember this is because there was an element of shame about the whole event that Australians were left behind as hostages to fortune. They knew that they'd be captured or killed. So there was an element of shame involved. I think the government just wanted to forget about it. The civilian women, you know, you can imagine the civilian families, the women who'd all been evacuated to Australia, spread around the country, hundreds and hundreds of them. They weren't allowed to talk about where they'd come from. Many of them weren't given much assistance. They were poor. Their husbands had access to bank accounts. So the women themselves just weren't allowed to access the money. So they suffered terribly, and then they didn't know what had happened to the men, their sons and husbands, brothers, left behind in Rabaul. And after the end of the war, there was still no explanation. Many of the men had just simply vanished. And to this day, that's traumatized whole families. Whole families still are reluctant to talk about it. Dickie's uncle, Graham, is in his 90s now. He's one of the few survivors of that generation of his family. And he survived because he was young and he didn't go to New Guinea, so he was still back in Australia. Their family never knew what happened. And today, Graham still can't really talk about it. He wants to, I think, but he gets to the point of trying to describe what happened during the war and he just can't do it. He breaks down and cries. And so the family themselves, the surviving family and the descendants, until I started researching this, never really knew what had happened to the family, because the family didn't talk about it. This is the case with many, I think, people who have been traumatized by war in this way, and particularly the people from Rabaul. the families, the women and the children who had been evacuated without the men and never really knew what happened. So the trauma has lasted. It is very, very sad. And part of the sadness is that it's still not recognised. It's still not recognised as an event, really. People don't really know much about it. And it's not discussed. We still don't talk about it much. The purpose in writing the book was to try to remedy a bit of that. But as I said, there doesn't seem to be much room in the Australian national story for Rabaul. It just doesn't seem to quite fit. Eventually, I think it might. I think it will. But at the moment, we still commemorate a sort of narrative that involves Singapore and the bombing of Darwin. And they're all worthy narratives and they're all significant events. But Rabaul doesn't quite fit in that narrative. And until we look more closely at what really happened after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the declaration of war and what happened to the people of New Guinea, and until we actually recognise Australia's history in New Guinea and Papua and recognise our very close relationship with Papua New Guinea, then I think that a lot of this will still be forgotten, unfortunately. So Dickie's story, as tragic as it was, is part of a bigger tragedy, and really what happened to him is indicative of what happened to many of the Australian civilians who'd left behind in Rabaul. Of course, Dickie's story, being an 11-year-old boy, an Australian schoolboy, he'd gone to Nailsworth School in Prospect and he'd gone to the West End State School in Brisbane when his mother was here. His experience is quite extraordinary, to be tried as a full court-martial that family faced over 3 days, and it was convened by the highest levels of the Japanese Navy, and then they were all taken out and shot. That story itself is just incredible.
Yeah. What was the lead up to that court-martial? It seems quite incredible when others were murdered. How come they were court-martialed?
Yeah, it's very complicated, as you know, what stories are. But what happened was, after the invasion, the family were on their plantation. Ted Harvey, this is Dickie's, I suppose, new stepfather, Marjorie's partner, on the plantation on the northern coast of New Britain. It's about 40 miles west of Rabaul, so they're on this sort of remote plantation on the coast. When the invasion happened, Ted Harvey had already put in supplies. He'd stocked up for a siege, basically, and had buried food supplies all around the place. So the family had a camp up in the jungle. So when the Japanese actually eventually did come storming ashore at the Lassall plantation where they lived, they had escape packs in the back veranda, and they just put on their packs and ran into the jungle. They were in the jungle for about 3 months, and the Japanese were hunting them, as they were hunting many Australians. At the time, the Japanese were worried about coast watches and positions of planes being reported and the Australians, civilians who were left behind trying to contact Australian forces. There were people up in the mountains with radios. There were coast watches all along the coast. The Japanese knew this, so they were trying to round them all up, basically. And the Harvey family was part of this roundup. They managed to stay in the jungle for 3 months before they were eventually captured. Well, it's a very complicated story about how they were captured, but they were betrayed, basically, by some local people. And the Japanese came into the clearing and surprised them. Dickie actually fought back at the time when the Japanese came. He was the only person in the clearing who fought them. He was only 11, but he was a big, strapping boy. If you look at a photograph of him when he was 10, he looks like he's about 16, really well muscled. His biological father was a wrestler, and Dickie really took after his biological father, Jack Gasmere. So when the Japanese came into the clearing to arrest them, they were all surprised. There wasn't much they could do. Ted Harvey was initially conscripted into the Coast Watch Service. They had a radio with which they were trying to contact the Australians to get them out. They came and searched the group, and Marjorie had a handbag. The handbag was upturned onto a table, and out fell a revolver. So this was a very bad thing. And so the Japanese soldiers who saw the revolver were upset by this, and one of them slapped Marjorie across the face, and Dickie, her son, came up and punched that soldier in the head and knocked him back, staggering. Dickie was quickly knocked to the ground by some other soldiers, of course, but this was about 3 months after they'd been hiding. They were taken by truck, boat, eventually came into Rabaul, where they were put into the prison where hundreds and hundreds of Australians who'd been round up were put into a stockade. And so what happened during the war, of course, is that the Japanese, they invaded Rabaul, took over the territory, and they imposed martial military law on that territory. And so as part of the military law, civilians weren't supposed to be combatants. Civilians were supposed to just sort of sit there and not take part, of course, but many civilians still felt loyal, of course, to Australia because they were Australians, and some of the civilians were allowed to stop on their plantations for a short time, although eventually they all vanished. And so Japanese martial law, of course, insisted that any sign of conflict was deemed an act of espionage or an act of aggression that was punishable severely under martial law. So the fact that this family, Marjorie and Dickie and Ted Harvey and Marjorie's brothers, who were still on the plantation, had a wireless set and a revolver, and there were reports as well that they were trying to signal. There was the Australians were starting to then retaliate and bomb the Japanese base at Rabaul. The family was trying to signal the Australians and point the way. We're using rocks on the beach and fire, smoke signals. This is what the Japanese claimed. So the family was then tried for these acts. The trial itself, of course, it was meant to make an example of the family, that the other civilians shouldn't try this. So they were interrogated quite politely by the Japanese Kempai Tai, the military police, and then there was a trial convened by, strangely enough, it was convened by the commander of the Japanese 4th Fleet, Inui. He was a very famous, very high-ranking Japanese commander. So he was the one who signed the court-martial documents. And so they were brought before the court, a court-martial. They weren't given a defence lawyer, but they were given an interpreter. And the trial lasted 3 days. There was evidence presented, and they were allowed to respond. But really, it wasn't supposed to be a fair trial. This was a military court, so it was a disciplinary court, really. So there was no sense that this was ever going to be a fair trial. So at the end of the court-martial, the family had to stand, and the judgment was read out in court, and the judgment said that the family was found guilty and that the consequences would be very severe. And when that was interpreted, even the interpreter thought, well, they're not going to be killed, this is just severe consequences. It doesn't sound, they're going to be interred for the rest of the war. So there was a sense of relief, I imagine. The court had actually determined that they were all to be shot. And so very soon after, about the 18th of May 1942, they were packed into the back of a truck. That was Ted Harvey, his wife Marjorie, 11-year-old Dickie, plus Marjorie's brother Jimmy, and another man who'd been on the plantation. And they were taken out to a volcano in the outskirts of Rabaul, near the site of the local garbage dump, which was at the base of this volcano. A hole had already been dug, and they were taken out, and Ted and Marjorie with Dickie between them, all holding hands, were lined up in front of this hole, and they were executed by firing squad, and then the others were executed, and the hole was buried. Their bodies had never been found, and there's no memorial still anywhere to these people or to any of the civilians, really, who died there at New Guinea. There are memorials, of course, to other people, but the Harvey family, the Manson family, Marjorie and Dickie and Ted, Jimmy, there's no memorial anywhere. And the gravesite has really been covered by subsequent eruptions, so what really happened there has been pretty much buried and forgotten. So, yeah, it's a very, very sad thing, the fact, really, that this could happen. But quite extraordinary story.
And right on our back door.
Yeah, yeah.
Ian, if the records are so few and far between for this era and what happened in Rabaul, where did you get your information from?
How did I know? There are very few records, that's very true. So it's surprising when people die how little is left, especially maybe not today with social media and emails. Maybe there'll be quite a lot of information left behind. But in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, surprising how little remains, especially when you consider a war zone. The court official records were destroyed as well. The Japanese, before the surrender, were ordered to destroy all these records, so the court-martial records were destroyed. So what's destroyed, and as I said, there's not much left of Dickie, but it's surprising how much does exist. So if you really try hard, you can find records in Japanese archives, Australian war crimes records, National Archives in Canberra, and the families, of course, even though they don't talk about it, still have photographs. Schools have records, so I've gone to the schools and newspapers, and you can trace the families, Marjorie's movements by passenger records. And so many of the people involved in the court-martial and execution of Dickey and his family died during the war, and the records are destroyed, but some people survived, including the interpreter who was there at the trial. Mm-hmm. In fact, a couple of people from the trial survived and were interrogated after the war. The execution of this family was to be the subject of a war crime trial, and a lot of documents were collected through interrogations of Japanese and Australians about what had happened. There are church records as well, and so you can piece together a picture of what happened, and the Australians themselves, soldiers who were fleeing after the invasion, were witnessed, the Harvey family fleeing into the jungle. The people who had reported the family to the Japanese, they survived, and their testimony survived. So it's surprising how much information you can find. I thought at first it would be very difficult, and it was very difficult, to get enough information to tell the story. But when you dig deep enough, all this information does eventually float to the surface, and you can start to piece things together. In the end, there are hundreds of witnesses to a person's life, and little scraps of information can help piece these stories together. So I have to say that this took about 8 years to tell the story of Rebel, and then the last couple of years to really look at the Harvey family. It took me about 6 months to talk to Graham Manson, Dickie's uncle, the family, and even though they didn't have much information, there was enough information to piece together the family's life. And there are letters, of course, that survived, although many didn't. And there are photographs, and you can, with a photograph where it's not really quite clear where the photograph was taken, you can start to look at things in the background and just work out movements and times and places. And then, you know, so much of the story that's, even though it's focused on Dickey and his family, the background is Rabaul and also World War II and also the volcanology. The minerals and the wealth of the Pacific and the volcanoes that really, strangely, played a part in the fate of this family. So there's a global, you know, geological and geographical story to tell as well about Rabaul and its fate and why it's that was the site of two world wars were fought in Rabaul. First World War, the Australians took Rabaul from the Germans. Why is Rabaul the centre of this focus? It was sought after by the Japanese and the Americans and the Australians and the Germans. It was highly sought after, this sort of crossroads of the Pacific. It's a beautiful harbour because it was an old volcano that had erupted and the caldera sank and the sea flooded in. And it's a perfect deep water harbour where a ship can come right up to the shore and load and offload all the things you can grow in a tropical climate like Rabaul, including rubber and copra, coconuts, cocoa. All those things were really important to trade back in the 1930s. And one of the reasons, of course, that Japan wanted Rabaul was to expand its trading empire. During the 1930s, it was industrializing rapidly and had a very fast-growing population, 1 million Japanese babies born every year. It needed to expand from its small group of islands where they had few resources. And then trade was prevented for political reasons during the 1930s by, you know, Americans and Australians. There was, so this crushing of trade with Japan and its attempt to rapidly industrialize and to see the growing population was one of the reasons that sparked its aggression during the 1930s, and as well as other things, of course. I mean, the military and political cultures came together to become quite aggressive and joined with the Japanese economy and trade and business to push for expanded markets and take them by force. So to understand all of this, to understand what happened to Dickey, it's not just a story you can look at in isolation. You've got to understand this wider geopolitical event, and even geologically what was going on can help really to understand, you know, the causes of the Second World War in the Pacific and what happened to this poor family of Australians.
Now, you mentioned War Crimes Tribunal. What happened there?
After the war, Australians convened a number of war crimes trials in Japan and in Rabaul to try many of the Japanese for war crimes that were starting to be reported just after the war finished. Prisoners of war were coming back. People were reporting terrible atrocities that had happened. So these the war crimes people set up commissions in Japan and New Guinea to work out what happened and to start to try any of the surviving Japanese. So that's what happened. A number of Japanese military people were hung in Rabaul. There was a gallows set up. But one of the main inquiries was the Harvey family. What happened to them? The execution. An enormous amount of work went into trying to get enough evidence to try some of the Japanese and some of the local people for what happened to the Harvey family. In the end, the collection of material seemed to go on for several years. The family back in Australia, by the way, wasn't really aware that this was going on. So they weren't really told. They were still kept in the dark, but the Australian Army had a large amount of information. And in the end, towards the end of the 1940s, these trials, a whole lot of trials had been happening. The Americans felt that a lot of the war crimes trials had gone on for so long that it was becoming dispiriting. And they just wanted, I think there was a sense that, you know, we should move on from the Second World War. So in the end, many trials, many cases were dropped. But although in the Harvey case, after all the evidence was collected, it was deemed to be difficult to actually find enough evidence to convict any one person of committing a war crime. The problem with the Harvey trial was that the court-martial was deemed to be properly convened under the rules of war. This was right at the start of the war, and the Japanese went to a lot of trouble, it seemed, to properly convene this court-martial. And because the family were strictly guilty of crime, they had a concealed radio, concealed weapons, it was considered that the court-martial would properly convene. It wasn't a war crime. Obviously, the execution of an 11-year-old boy is extraordinary, but it was unclear, I think, to the Japanese how old Dickie was. But of course, you know, and then there becomes just speculation as to why they chose to execute him with his parents rather than let him go. And the other issue, of course, was that Ted Harvey, Marjorie's partner, with Marjorie, went to Japan in 1940 after the declaration of war with Germany, but before Japan had ended the war. They went to Japan and did attempt to spy for Australia on the Japanese. The twist in the tale, if you like, is that the family were actually spies. Whether this was revealed in the court-martial, it's not clear because the documents didn't exist. There are army records involving discussions about Ted Harvey, this man who was going with his wife and child to Japan and reporting back in Sydney to the army about what he'd seen in the harbour with the Japanese military build-up. The Australian army didn't want him to do this, so Ted Harvey was a bit of a strange character. He was a little bit unstable, and I think he was doing this thing off his own bat in an attempt, I think, to try to do his bit, I guess, but he was told not to do it, but he insisted on going to Japan and spying for Australia and brought back information, which the army duly recorded, but told him not to do it again. So, you know, Harvey's sense of duty, if you like, or his warped sense of duty probably was partly responsible for his family being killed. He may have tried to persuade them that, you know, stay in Rabaul after the invasion and do their bit for the country, and Marjorie might have been persuaded, and God knows why poor old Dickie stayed with them, but the family decided to stay instead of come back to Australia. Of course, if Marjorie had come back, she would have been leaving this lifestyle and the money that Ted Harvey had and might never have seen him again, and she would have had no access to it. So it was a bit of a gamble for Marjorie to actually stay in New Guinea, I suspect, because if she'd come back to Australia, she would have just been penniless. So hard to know what choice should have been made, but many people in New Guinea didn't really expect an invasion, and if they did, then it was expected that the war wouldn't last very long and the Americans would come to the rescue. And it's hard to be too critical, I guess, of Marjorie's decision to stay behind and keep Dickie with her. But they didn't know then what we know now. That was a very unfortunate series of events.
And perhaps as a family, they felt secure because of that very situation, rather than just Ted by himself.
That's right. And they prepared, so that on balance, perhaps, they certainly thought they were doing the right thing by staying behind. And on balance, given the information they had at the time, it might have been a reasonable decision. In the end, you know, it exposed them all to danger and it got them killed.
Terrible. Ian, I presume you've been to Rabaul yourself, and what happened?
Yes, beautiful. it's a wonderful, wonderful place. The town of Rabaul was called the Jewel of the Pacific back in the 1930s. It was a beautiful town. The frangipani trees and the poincianas and the bougainvillea, and every house had gorgeous gardens. And you can imagine these rows of old Queenslander homes. People went to a lot of trouble to tend their gardens with crotons and tropical plants, and the town was just a blaze of colour. And these beautiful old pubs, German architecture, because the Germans built it originally, but wooden, double-storied, wide-verandaed buildings. Beautiful town. And if you see the photographs, you can understand why. It was built inside a volcanic caldera, but at the time, there hadn't been an eruption for a long time, so people weren't really aware. They thought the volcanoes that sort of studded the landscape and the hills around them were extinct. So they felt very secure in this town. There was a big eruption in 1937, which rocked everybody a bit, but the town survived with some ash. But no buildings or a couple of buildings were damaged, but not much. So the town was pretty well destroyed in the Second World War. The Americans and the Australians bombed it constantly for 4.5 years. It was Australia's and America's longest running battle, if you like, the air battle over Rabaul. And so the town was just obliterated as the Americans tried to dislodge the Japanese, because the Japanese had made Rabaul its stronghold. You imagine an Australian town of a couple of thousand people, when the Japanese invaded, they turned it into a city of 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. It had civilians and shops and factories, as well as the military. So it became a Japanese town, and it was just obliterated by the Americans over a period of time. So now, it was rebuilt after the war. Australia recaptured it. It was rebuilt, architecture of the 1950s and 60s. And then in 1994, there was a big eruption, and that pretty well covered the town in meters of ash, and it was just deemed too dangerous to stay there. So most of the town is now gone. You can walk down these streets if you're going to go to Rabaul. It's worth stopping in the old part of the town, because you can walk out onto the street and look around on the vacant blocks, but the street markings are still there where cars used to pull up in the front of the shops. So it's a bit of a ghost town, a little bit of a Pompeii. And Kokopo now, down the coast, is probably the main centre for New Britain. But Rabaul's still a very important port. It's one of the most seismically active places on the planet. And there was one point, I think, where there was this enormous earthquake where Rabaul jumped half a metre north in the space of a couple of seconds. This whole peninsula just moved and caused a lot of damage, of course. And if you walk over the caldera onto the northern side, you'll see the coastline where Dickie and his family lived, in this magnificent scene north, and the beautiful crystal clear water and coral reefs along that section of coast with the palm trees. It's everybody's vision of paradise, this beautiful calm seas and lovely beaches and turquoise water. I feel as if it's a part of Australia that's been lost and probably should be recognised a bit more.
And I couldn't agree with you more. Ian Townsend, thank you very much for bringing us the Manson family's story of Rabaul, and in particular, Dickie Manson's.
Thanks, Helen.